I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. What might possess a grade school kid to try his hand at first aid for ailing trees?
There's a photograph of me standing next to a tree with a look of what can only be described as admiration and love, next to a white oak tree that apparently had two main stems right down at the base, and I called it the two-headed white tree. In the backyard, we had a black oak tree that was infested with insects. It had a little hole in it. I thought that the carpenter ants made it. I was determined to figure out exactly what made that perfectly round hole in that tree. I used to try experiments on them because I got medicine, so why can't a tree get medicine? I so anthropomorphized these things, I would bring out a household chemical like hydrogen peroxide, mix it with water, and pour it on the roots of that two-headed white tree because, you know, it kills germs when mom puts it on a cut, so why shouldn't it kill germs that are trying to invade this tree? I don't recall this, but it wouldn't surprise me if I put something like antibiotics on it, or a little A&D ointment, you know, something like that. Yeah, it's something that just fascinated me all through when I was a kid. I don't know what it was about me and trees.
Emmett Hoops is a grade school teacher in upstate New York. One of Emmett's lifelong passions has been to help trees, but most particularly, to help restore the American chestnut tree. He knows the history of this tree. Over four decades, from 1904 to the mid-1940s, a deadly fungus nearly killed off the American variety of chestnut. Chestnut blight, the villain, was a stowaway crossing the Pacific Ocean on imported ornamental chestnut trees from China and Japan, leaving only scattered survivors of the vulnerable American chestnut tree still clinging to life.
It bothered me when I was little, and it's bothered me all my life. I'm 64 now. I never, ever lost that sense. We still have a chance to undo an historic wrong. This is something I've been waiting for since I'm 7 years old.
The American chestnut thrived in the Appalachian Mountains and adjacent regions from Alabama to Maine. They were massive, the redwoods of the East, towering over 10 stories tall. This variety of tree, with its lumber and most importantly with its prolific and nutritious nut crop, was woven into the very fabric of existence for countless wildlife species, and a species not so wild, millions of humans. In parts of the eastern forests, one out of four trees was an American chestnut.
One out of four trees in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and central New York. It's not just a tree. It's the source of food. 80% of the food in the forest. 80%. What happened to the animals in the forest, in those parts of the country where the chestnut was the dominant tree species? Four species of moth disappeared at the same time as the chestnut, and this just blew me away. I thought, how much food has disappeared because of this tree?
If I know anything about the people who get involved in tree conservation, it's these two things above all else. Number one, they're patient. Number two, they're passionate. In this episode of Constant Wonder, we turn our sights on American chestnut trees, the people who love them, the scientists who study them, and the daunting challenge of restoring them. It shouldn't be hard for any of us to fall in love with the American species of chestnut. It's a marvelous natural phenomenon, kind of a rock star. If the ancient Israelites, rather than collecting the miracle of manna from up off the ground, had been able to gather up American chestnuts, well, the whole golden calf scene might have been avoided. Emmett Hoops vividly remembers the first time he saw an ailing American elm and also on that same day, a dead American chestnut tree. His family had been attending church while on vacation in a tiny Appalachian town on the Greenbrier River.
It was a hot Sunday, and it was Ronsvort, West Virginia. And we'll never forget that it was Ronsvort, West Virginia, because back in the 60s, there was this AM radio station and an announcer who kept saying where the station was located. He had a very deep voice, and he would say, "Welcome to Ronsvort, West Virginia." It was so hot in the church, and I was a restless little kid. I was 6 or 7 at that time. And I came out, and an American elm by the sidewalk was clearly not doing well. It had crispy brown leaves, yellow leaves. I can still see this tree. It was a fairly young American elm. I had no idea what was wrong with it, and my father came out from church to check on me, make sure I wasn't running across the road. Well, he could have trusted me if there was a tree there to stare at. So I had this pencil, and I was chipping away at the bark on this tree to try to find some insect that was the cause of this tree's illness. I thought that if I could find the one bug that was causing this tree problems, that I could remove that bug and the tree would be healthy again. Well, I was unable to find one. Church was over, my father comes out and he points down a little further. There was another elm tree that was healthy. And he explained about Dutch elm disease and how the healthy tree was eventually going to get sick as well because it was right next to a diseased tree. And I remember thinking trees can catch a disease the way people can catch a disease. If you're near somebody who's sneezing, you might get a cold.
Emmett's father seems to have been in the know, not only about the identity of these native elm trees, but about what was wiping them out. And then he pointed to another arboreal tragedy nearby, a different species altogether with its own specific disease. This one not merely sick, but dead.
There was the hulk of an American chestnut, big and white. It had no bark on it at all. It looked like a telephone pole. My father said that was a chestnut tree. And when he said, "They're gone, the chestnut is gone," I thought, how could a tree possibly have been planted here? And now not only this one is dead, but there aren't any to be found. You know, my father didn't know that there actually are regrowths. He thought that they were just absolutely extinct.
It's likely you remember Miracle Max from The Princess Bride. Working to revive the hero Wesley with a chocolate-coated miracle pill, Max draws a distinction between being dead and only mostly dead. This is how things have gone with the American chestnut tree. The species is not fully extinct. Trees here and there are only functionally extinct, with roots still alive. Yes, the mammoth tree specimens that once towered over Appalachian forests are no longer there, conspicuous as before. But stunted living remnants are scattered, which means that the population of trees out in nature is still clinging to life.
If you go into the forest, you'll find American chestnuts. They look like rhododendrons, which grow about maybe 15 feet high, and they become very bushy instead of growing straight up.
These scattered survivors usually die back, not die off, mind you, only die back, before they're old enough to bear fruit. It's a tenuous kind of persistence, with new shoots growing from old stumps, and it's a process that may not last indefinitely. These younger shoots are not quite as vulnerable as the older growth of many years. This is a crucial point. It means that still today, there is vital genetic material to be found scattered about through the woods. Only mostly dead, as Miracle Max would say.
If you tell a 7-year-old that something is extinct, you're thinking, this is a dinosaur, and if I can find out what's wrong, this thing isn't so far back in history that I can't save it. I wanted to find other American chestnuts that were sick so I could find the thing that was responsible for it.
If these noble trees could grow 10 stories tall, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 130 feet tall. Not nearly as wide, though, less than 20 feet across at the canopy's greatest width. Use those numbers to imagine the trunk. Straight-grained, very long and erect, well-suited for splitting and milling into planks of lumber, fence posts, shingles. The wood was also particularly rot-resistant, highly favored for making furniture. It's hard to overstate how central the American chestnut tree once was in the lives of those who lived under its branches. It's also hard to overstate how ubiquitous they were.
Now, this next holler around the curve, there's a place up in there, chestnuts, and there wasn't nothing but chestnuts, but whole mountainside there full of chestnuts, just mostly chestnut trees. They called that the chestnut flat.
All of these ridges and the mountains were covered with chestnut trees. They were up the tallest trees around. I'm satisfied we'll grow 100 feet in height. And they were just huge at the ground. Some of them as much as 7 feet in diameter. Old people had a saying that when the chestnuts bloomed, they'd say the snow was in the mountain. They could see them white blooms on the trees from anywhere around here. And they grow so thick it looked like a field of corn or something. They were real plentiful.
These are the voices of Harding Eisen and Eugene Day, old-timers who remembered seeing thousands upon thousands of healthy, vibrant American chestnut trees way back during those first years of what has been called the greatest disaster in American forest history. These two voices, and others that we have yet to hear, were recorded for posterity by Bethany N. Baxter. Back in 2008, Baxter was assembling an oral history of the American chestnut. She was working on her master's degree at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. These eyewitnesses that she recorded remembered how the chestnut fed you. It fed your livestock. It fed the game in the forest. Sometimes you could sell a crop's excess to get groceries or store goods. And of course, I've just mentioned the massive trunks of straight-grained, rot-resistant lumber. Apparently, nobody ever seemed to get tired of eating its fruit. Here's Elsie Boggs.
Well, when I was small, we had chestnut trees. We grew up on quite a number of acres of land, probably 15 acres. There were chestnut trees close by our house. Of course, we always gathered them as soon as they were ready to be gathered and mature enough. We would roast some of them in the fireplace under the ashes. Let the hot coals drop down on them. They tasted delicious. Then my mother would boil big pots of them and keep them sitting around for us that we could eat on them any time.
They were a food staple. They were faithful every year. I think lots of people were saved by eating those chestnuts because they had so many good vitamins in them. And they were so good, so delicious. There just wasn't anything any better.
That's C.E. Blevins, who was born around 1925 in northern Tennessee near the Kentucky line. His early memories are of abundant chestnuts.
They were beautiful. I thought they were just pretty. And that food stuff was the main thing. And we'd roast them and boil them and eat them raw. Oh, we kids got fat.
When Blevins was six, his family moved south to work a tenant farm near the Georgia and Alabama lines. This happened at the very cusp of the Great Depression. It was a region where poverty and hunger were already endemic, and the chestnut blight was coming on strong in that area, which was a kick in the gut for the poor tenant farmers.
We were shocked as a six-year-old child, and I had a brother, a nine-year-old, and one 3 years old. We never saw a live chestnut tree on that farm, but we found chestnut trees dead. If they had been counted carefully, there might have been as many as 150 to 200 trees. This was January of 1931. To me, it was like a human death almost. We missed them. We suffered from them, the lack of them, because we would have had good food. My mother would have made all kinds of stuff out of them. We would have just served them on the table. They would have been great, boiled or baked. It'd been great food, healthy food, nourishing food. And of course, us six boys, we needed them.
You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our guest in this episode is the American chestnut tree. Along with people who have loved it and continue to love it, and people whose aim is to restore it. Ella Preston would be 107 years old if living today. We're about to hear her talking about what it was like going nutting back in the day, and how she learned the hard way about the limited shelf life of chestnuts. Few people living today can claim to have eaten American chestnuts that have been foraged directly from off the ground beneath the tree that produced them.
My name is Ella Preston, and I was born November 26, 1916, and I will be 92 years old in December.
Ella Preston was a friend of Bethany Baxter's grandmother, 92 when Baxter recorded these memories in 2008. The advent of the chestnut blight coincided with Ella's childhood. When she was only 5, her family moved to a new home, and her earliest memories there include harvesting the bounty of dead American chestnut trees.
All this time, I was aware of the dead trees I could see up on the hill, and I found out they were chestnuts. They were standing above the other trees, not a limb on them, no leaves either. But one had a few chestnuts I found laying under it. So I picked up a handful, all I could find, and ran to the house to show my mother, and she cooked them for me.
The nuts Ella found under leafless trees were not rotten, so we can assume the trees on that spot hadn't been dead all that long. When she became a teenager, the chestnut trees around her home were long gone, but apparently if you drove southeast, what would be a 90-minute drive today on modern roads, you could still find some, but to get there, you'd have to park and then hike in and camp.
One exciting, cold, frosty morning when I was about 13, I heard my Uncle John and a man above us called George were taking a bunch of us girls to pick up native chestnuts. And that was a rarity. We were going to camp and spend the night and pick chestnuts up and bring them back the next day. So away we went. And we were quite a rowdy bunch going. We were fresh, and we picked up chestnuts as we went. When we got over across Pine Mountain on the other side to a branch they call Bad Branch, and by then it was getting late, so we looked for a place to camp. And George had lived in that area when he was first married, so he could pretty well tell us where to go. And we found a nice big cliff, built us a bonfire, broiled our meat, and had a hilarious supper. Of course, by dark, we were ready to go to bed. We fixed us a bed, and these two men were pretty good singers, and they started singing old-time songs, and they made that valley ring. They sang so loud, and they sang us all to sleep.
I see lost men, hungry and cold. How did he get there? Well, searching for gold.
We ate breakfast and started picking up chestnuts in earnest next morning, and George knew just where to take us, and he found all the chestnuts, and I really worked and picked up. When the day was getting pretty late, we had to start home because we had nearly 5 miles, I guess, to walk, and I had so many chestnuts I couldn't carry them. So George was sorry for me, and he put them on that horse and carried them home. Next day, my father had to go up to George's home and get my chestnuts. So he brought them home, and my mother put them in the closet up next to the chimney. Time passed. I was in school, and they were busy with the farm work. My mother would say, "I saw some little white worms crawling around. I wonder where they come from." So I didn't know. Every day for about a week, she'd mention something about seeing the worms. Finally, it dawned on her what had happened. And those chestnuts had exploded into all a million, seemed like, worms. They had all the eggs that hatched in them where it was warm, and they hadn't done anything to stop it. So that ended my native chestnut hunt. They had to throw all my chestnuts away.
In case you were wondering, yes, worms and insects infest nut crops just like they do fruit crops. Eating those worms, along with the nut meat, isn't likely to kill you, but I don't know many people who would want to. I wouldn't, and Ella's family didn't. But the really unexpected moment for me in Ella Preston's memories was her casual aside about squirrels tasting a little yummier for having plumped themselves on the right kind of diet. I don't know if you've ever hunted squirrels for food, but most folks are just as unlikely to eat squirrels as nutworms.
And in the mountains, gray squirrels is something they hunt. And if a gray squirrel eats chestnuts or hazelnuts or beech nuts, their flesh is much sweeter than one that just lives on whatever they find, hickory nuts or anything.
I wish I could say that I'm a full 6 degrees of separation from folk who've eaten squirrel. I took the matter to my wife, who is from Appalachia. Sarah tells me that I'm probably only 3 degrees away. But she was also quick to add, it's no actual blood relation, but someone her father once knew. Putting aside value judgments about culture and dietary preferences, impoverished populations throughout history find that manna from heaven might come in nearly any shape or size. Ella wasn't talking up squirrel hunting as a sport. And maybe gray squirrels do taste better for the chestnuts. This is actually the perfect time now to mention hogs, and here's how I'll do it. The country's chestnuts bloomed in June, so the trees dodged late frosts and produced every year. Many other nut crops are vulnerable to late frosts or for other reasons don't produce reliably or abundantly every year. So you can see how with massive annual chestnut harvests, just about every strand along the web of life might prosper, and the hogs of Appalachia got in on the bounty.
Hogs was crazy over chestnut. When we was getting them in the little chestnut orchard, you'd have to go at daylight to beat the hogs. Or they'd get there and get them. Or if you went and thrashed them out with something to pick them up, some of us would have to keep the hogs, you know, shoot off, for they would go in and get them. They loved them.
Bethany Baxter's interviews for her oral history project offer lots of confirmation that in the old times, hogs and chestnuts went together like PB&J. Here's an old-timer named Lee Sexton.
People used to turn their cattle and hogs and sheep and everything out in the mountains. My grandfather, he lived just across the creek here, right over there. I guess he had 25 or 30 hogs.
If you don't already know it, I'll tell you now that Lee Sexton was a Kentucky banjo legend. When asked by Bethany Baxter to introduce himself, he spent more time introducing his banjo.
My name's Lee Sexton, and I live on the old farm here that I was born and raised on, and that's my old home right down there I was born in. And I'm 80 year old. And I've been playing banjo 73 years. And I've still got the same banjo that I learned to play on. Fretless wooden screw, and it had a groundhog hide on it. I gave $1 for it. My grandfather had, he lived just across the creek here, right over there. I guess he had 25 or 30 hogs. He would fatten them hogs. They would get fat on chestnuts and acorns. Whenever he wanted one to kill, he'd just step up at the barn and start calling his hogs.
I might be only 2 degrees of separation from hogs that fattened up on wild chestnuts in the West Virginia hills. My wife's great-grandfather knew how to butcher a hog. Suffice it to say, When it comes to hogs, that if learning by experience is one measure of intelligence, the hogs Lee Sexton was talking about might not have been as smart as these animals are cracked up to be. And when humans weren't eating chestnuts, or making lumber from the durable wood, or turning their hogs loose to forage under the trees, or eating the squirrels, deer, or wild turkey that devoured the nuts, well, these people might just gather them up to sell or trade. The market for chestnuts wasn't limited to Appalachia. Here's a newspaper essay about the annual chestnut harvesting tradition of central Connecticut. The date of this article was November 8, 1894.
The mountains of Connecticut are covered with vast forests of chestnut trees. The harvest is gathered year after year. After the second or third heavy frost, there is a family exodus to the woods. Chestnut gatherers are out in the woods at 5 o'clock in the morning and remain there till almost dark. The big boys, or the men, climb the trees and shake the limbs, standing as far out as they dare, and then, by holding to a limb overhead, they stamp up and down. The limb springs back with a snap, and the chestnuts come down through the leaves like a shower of hailstones. No attempt is made to gather the nuts while the tree is being shaken. The members of the party stand off at a respectful distance and look on. They're afraid of the keen, pointed burrs falling on the face, neck, and hands. After the tree has been shaken, one of the boys rakes up the leaves and the burrs, and the place is well cleared. Then the chestnut gatherers work along the ground on their knees. Each picker drops the nuts into a small canvas bag, which he or she wears around the neck. When the bag is filled, the contents are emptied into a bushel basket or a large sack. And so one tree after another is shaken and made to yield a valuable harvest. The chestnut gatherers sell their crop by weight. The average price paid is about 4 cents a pound, or $2.25 per bushel. Thus, the earnings of the family of four or five people will often be as high as $10 a day. The season is short and lasts about 3 weeks. The pickers would like it to continue for 3 months.
Adjusting for inflation, $10 then is about $350 today. For a cash-poor family of tenant farmers, that was quite a bounty. Whether for cash or trade, chestnuts were an economic boon for lots of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these people picked up chestnuts here and put them in the store to sell. You know, they'd sell them to the grocery. Or back in, what you done, you traded them. Money was short. They would take those chestnuts and trade them just like they do eggs. Trade them for groceries, you know. The groceryman, he would allow you so much for a 5-pound bag of chestnuts, you know. So there had no money transferred back and forth.
I think they used to trade them to the peddlers. There used to be peddlers come through here on a bus. They had everything. They'd buy chickens and everything. And I think you could trade them chestnuts for about 25 cents a pound, I think, or something, for whatever you needed, coffee or sugar and everything like that.
My wife's mother saved up. She wanted a pump organ. She picked up chestnuts to buy the pump organ. Sold them. What would you guess, Esther, how much a bushel? Maybe a quarter? So she had to make $17 for the pump organ. Probably maybe a used one, or was it new?
Now, if you were a kid in chestnut country in the old days, there's a good chance you spent 3 seasons barefoot and watched every step. The spiky burrs that encased the nut were downright dangerous. Here's Emmett Hoops.
Well, you ever pick up a chestnut? It's like picking up a sea anemone. Spikes all over the outside of the shell. You could see why they wouldn't necessarily want to replant the street with American chestnuts, even though there are a lot of chestnut streets, because I can just imagine what some vicious little 8-year-old is going to do with a spiky little chestnut, you know, hurl them across the street.
Those spines or spurs certainly had their evolutionary purpose, protecting the nut to enhance chances of eventual germination. The old-timers, though, seem to have found the burr's dangers to be charming and amusing, if sometimes painful, wincingly so. Thanks to Bethany Baxter's oral histories, we don't need to imagine what impudent or careless kids would do with chestnut burrs. Bloody burr fights were part of the territory. Banjo legend Lee Sexton.
We had to walk backwards and forwards to school, and went barefooted, and we would race to that chestnut tree. And if one got more chestnuts than, they'd take them burrs and take them right inside the head with them or anything. We wore knee breeches, hit them on the legs, and they'd bring the blood.
Those kids must have been pretty tough, and some boys prided themselves in proving it.
I went barefooted and got so that I could stomp chestnut burrs with my heel. And, of course, it's partly showing off at school. We had a ball field out there, and the left field was where the chestnut trees were. And that's generally where I played because a lot of the kids didn't, you know, around those chestnut burrs, they never were picked up on the school ground, you know, one year to the next. Well, there's always burrs down there. If somebody come around to look at me, I might stomp one to show off.
So what happens if a chestnut burr should happen to fall on your head from, 10 stories up? According to Lee Sexton, this wasn't hypothetical, and he had a story to illustrate why.
And there's an old preacher by the name of Far Eaton Jim Caudle. He'd come to church, and he'd have on overalls like I've got on, barefooted, his breechy legs rolled up just below his knees, and his ankles and legs would be just as rusty, he never washed, and top of his head, he didn't have no hair, and you could see the dirt right on the top of his head. But boy, he could preach it. He's making prayer up there in these three big chestnut trees there. And one of them big burrs fell out of that chestnut tree and whacked him right on top of the head. The blood spun out of the top of his head. And he never let up. He just kept making prayer and wiping that blood.
Chestnut blight was first noted in New York City in 1904. No one had had the slightest inkling that importing foreign chestnuts could do any harm. The business of America being business, for a handful of entrepreneurs in New Jersey, their business was to produce really big chestnuts. On April 9, 1892, the Jamesburg Record notes that the Mammoth Chestnut Company, based in Camden, New Jersey, was setting out to make millions with giant new hybrids.
The company owns a natural chestnut grove containing 350 acres in Camden County, the prettiest and most productive piece of chestnut timber in the United States. We have had the entire tract cleared and the chestnut trees cut off a few feet above the ground, says Wooster. The wood we obtained more than paid for the expense. Now we have men working on grafting slips from the Japanese chestnut trees to the stumps, and in 2 years we'll be picking up nuts as big as this. And here Mr. Wooster pulled out a mammoth Japanese chestnut that measured 6.5 inches in circumference from his pocket to illustrate. You see, continued Mr. Wooster, there are now many improved kinds of chestnuts, but the largest of all is the Japanese, and they have been cultivating their chestnuts for centuries and have almost reached perfection. American chestnuts, however, have never been cultivated, and we propose to perfect the Japanese chestnut by the grafting process, which will introduce all the sweetness and flavor of the wild American nut. The advantage of the Japanese nut is that it bears 2 or 3 weeks earlier than any other chestnut, and we will thus get into market when the fruit is scarce and get the cream of the prices.
1892, the year of that article's publication, was 12 years before anybody noticed the blight. So did the Mammoth Chestnut Company's pursuit of mammoth profits by grafting Japanese branches onto American chestnut trunks, did that bring the blight here? Do we have a culprit? Probably not. As it turns out, the producers at Mammoth had obtained their slips of Japanese chestnut wood from nurseries, and that means that the blight had already arrived and was spreading. A stealthy enemy often infiltrates a city before anybody can close the gates. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our guest in this episode is the American chestnut tree. And we're also talking to some of the tree's friends, like Emmett Hoops, and hearing snippets of oral history specific to the American chestnut story. These voices were recorded by Bethany Baxter. If ever a tree had personality, then from what we've heard so far in this episode, it's fair to say that the American chestnut had a nearly charismatic personality. What's more, the very fortune of the people living beneath the chestnut canopy was interwoven with the fate of the tree. Chestnuts were the supporting pillars in the natural, wild community, and human society leaned on that community fundamentally. People were not just passionate about chestnuts, they were dependent upon them. We're going to return next to Emmett Hoops to expand our sense for his life journey linked to this tree, and we're going to hear how he discovered something of a spiritual home with a group of American chestnut enthusiasts. And we'll even hear how his elementary students have turned their attention to the grand hope of restoration of this species, hoping to do it before the door of possibility closes. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Emmett Hoops was only 7 years old when he first fancied himself a rescuer of trees. And if he's 64 today, that would have been around about 1967, long before you or I or he could Google chestnut blight. So it was years before he could easily access the stuff he wanted to know in order to engage in the cause.
With the dawn of the internet, I was looking up American chestnuts, and all I found online were hybrids, something called the Dunstan chestnut, or this chestnut, or a Chinese chestnut, or a European chestnut, but no one was selling American chestnuts. And that eventually got me in touch with the American Chestnut Foundation and the New York chapter. They were brimming with news about coming up with possible solutions to blight and introducing blight tolerance into American chestnuts. Finally, I found what felt like a spiritual home. I've been involved with the American Chestnut Foundation's New York chapter ever since.
Emmett is currently director for District 5 of the New York chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation, which covers much of the northeastern part of his state. He's also vice president for outreach for the New York chapter.
The New York chapter is affiliated with the State University of New York School of Environmental Science and Forestry, SUNY ESF. We have had a very productive partnership with SUNY ESF that we hope to continue in the future.
Emmett himself is not a professional trained scientist, but as you might expect from someone with a lifelong passion for the American chestnut tree, he's well-read on the topic, incredibly well-informed.
You can't entirely filter out all of the characteristics of a Chinese chestnut when you are making a hybrid. You're always bringing a whole bunch of genetic information rather than one or two specific genes that are adapted for a specific purpose. If we have the wild American chestnut up there as the platonic ideal, I don't think we're going to approach that ideal with hybrids, probably ever. So I think that the real choice is between just waiting for the immune system to adapt or helping it along by finding an American plant that already coexists in the environment and extracting the gene responsible for blight tolerance in that plant and putting it into a chestnut. As it happens, some other plants in North America, such as the red oak and American red wheat, both have a gene that, if you put it into another organism, confers blight tolerance. While if you put it into a chestnut, you have a blight-tolerant chestnut. It's a lot more complicated than just doing that or everybody would be doing it, but it seems like a really promising avenue, and that's the one that I am supporting. Now, some people think that that creates all kinds of new hazards. I am not among that group, but I think that that is the most promising way to go forth.
As Emmett Hoops waits for geneticists to succeed in producing blight-resistant American chestnut trees, he's quick to say we ought to still be planting traditional, unmodified American chestnuts, even if most of these will die back. This is simply to make the range of genetic diversity as wide as possible. So planting nuts from surviving wild American chestnuts is an important safeguard for maintaining the species overall. And when it comes to evangelizing about spreading the trees, Emmett has a rapt audience in the elementary students he teaches. It can't be just coincidence that the 7-year-old chestnut nut who grew up applying hydrogen peroxide to the roots of sick trees eventually found himself in classrooms in front of 6- and 7-year-olds. For kids that age, why shouldn't tree conservation be part of the curriculum?
For the past 7 years, I've given all the kids American chestnuts, just plain old, pure American chestnuts that, if you're lucky enough to find a tree that's not dead from blight and is still bearing fruit, pick them up. Don't do it without gloves. And I've been distributing them to kids in my class, and we always pick four that we plant every year. And I got permission to plant them in a special place on school property. So I have this whole section in front of my school where we're planting American chestnuts, knowing that they may, in fact, die from blight, but for very complex reasons, it actually makes sense to have a bunch of these not blight-tolerant trees growing. And the kids who were in my class, every time they're in the bus turning into school, they have told me in subsequent grades, they still look at those chestnuts and they realize that they planted those things. The biggest tree right now is between 8 and 10 feet tall. They're doing really well. You know, for little kids, like I said before, all you have to do with a little kid is to say, this thing might never exist again, and you are helping this thing to continue to exist. They may as well be dealing with a T-Rex or a Brontosaurus, something that is already gone that they didn't have a chance to help. But here they have this tree that they're actively helping. It's hard to get that passion from a 40-year-old, but I guarantee you, you will not have a problem telling a 7-year-old, we're going to plant a tree that may not exist anymore if we don't keep planting these trees.
You've been listening to Constant Wonder. The American chestnut tree has been our leading actor in this episode, with supporting roles taken up by a number of humans. We heard the voice of Emmett Hoops, who framed for us with his personal story, The Plight of Sickly Trees Afflicted by Exotic Blights. Not just American chestnuts, but other endangered or nearly extinct species as well. Dutch elm disease, which he mentioned, comes to mind. And then we heard recollections from the invaluable oral history collection about American chestnuts, prepared in 2008 by Bethany N. Baxter. Emmett Hoops acquainted us with some of the scientific issues and challenges that confront restoration of the chestnut trees. If you'd like to hear from a leading chestnut restoration scientist, stick around with us for a bit. After the episode concludes, we have a bonus for you, a 10-minute conversation with Andy Newhouse. He is director of the American Chestnut Project at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. It's a great conversation and touches on a number of questions about the chestnut, including some compelling history for you, evidence that Native Americans may have carried the chestnut great distances across North America. I'm Marcus Smith. Today's episode was produced by Eric Schultzke with help from Audrey Hughes, Elaine Scott, and Mamie Teeples. Sound design by James Call. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio. I recently had an opportunity to visit with Andy Newhouse, director of the American Chestnut Project, which is housed at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. And because I've eaten chestnuts sold in stores, an obvious question for me is a pretty straightforward question. What am I really getting when I buy these things? Where do they come from?
When you buy chestnuts, they're almost certainly from hybrid plants, maybe European or Chinese or some combination of those species. There's definitely a growing chestnut industry. There are lots of people who grow trees, mostly hybrids, so they're not as susceptible to the blight. And the chestnuts they produce are much bigger. They have other traits, like they're easier to peel and they ripen consistently. So those are important if, of course, you're growing chestnuts to sell. And if you want to buy a bag of chestnuts, it's better if they're easy to peel and more convenient if they're larger. Those things aren't as important for a restoration project.
If you remember the early days of the COVID pandemic, efforts were made to mitigate or even counter the incursion of the virus into the United States and North America. So a logical question for me to ask Andy Newhouse during our conversation was this: were any efforts made after the blight's arrival to impede its progress.
There were some traditional methods of using fungicides. There are things that can be sprayed on trees to suppress fungal infections that people were aware of and tried on chestnut blight. There were efforts to cut down whole swaths of chestnuts in forests in an attempt to prevent the spread of the fungus. Neither of those things worked very well, partly because people didn't understand the nature of the blight fungus very well and that it can survive on other species. So even if the chestnut trees are cut down, the blight fungus can survive on other trees, even if it doesn't do damage on those other trees. And in some cases, people might have actually spread the blight fungus through these cutting and thinning efforts. Over the next few decades, people attempted planting related species. They realized early on that Asian chestnut species, so Japanese chestnuts and Chinese chestnuts, tended to tolerate the blight a lot better. And so there were early efforts to just plant Chinese chestnuts. And you can still eat the chestnuts. They still have some similar values. But the trees are pretty different. They're not as cold tolerant. They don't grow as tall. The chestnuts themselves are a lot bigger. So the types of wildlife that can eat them is pretty limited. It was clearly not a direct replacement for American chestnuts. So then people started crossbreeding them and trying to take advantage of traits of both of those species. Those efforts are ongoing today. There's a lot of potential there. But it was, and still is, very clear that the Asian species don't have the same traits that people liked about American chestnut and just don't have the same traits that suit them well to eastern U.S. forests. And then there were even some pretty out there efforts to use really unique technologies. One involved using radiation. So post-Cold War, there was an effort to use this new idea of radiation for something other than bombs, I guess. And people realized that radiation could induce mutations, that it can change DNA. And in some cases, that resulted in beneficial traits on other plants. If they exposed seeds to the right dose of radiation that didn't kill the seed but induced some mutations, sometimes those mutations are beneficial. And that's resulted in some unique and beneficial foods that are still part of our food systems today. So people actually tried that with chestnuts, tried exposing seeds to radiation in hopes that mutation would spontaneously happen and result in chestnut blight resistance. That didn't work. We're not aware of any chestnut blight resistance from that program, despite thousands of seedlings being planted out. But people were trying lots of different things and really still are passionate about trying to protect and restore this species.
Native Americans, indigenous interactions with the chestnut tree, anything there?
Well, we can definitely say that the trees were desirable and that forests were managed by both Europeans and indigenous groups for chestnuts and that they were harvested and used as food. One specific anecdote, I guess, is that there was a study of genetic diversity of American chestnuts looking at the ways or the pattern of the ways American chestnuts dispersed after the last glaciers receded. And so the expectation and most of the pattern that was observed in this genetic study was that chestnuts were only present in the southern half or so of the eastern U.S. during the glaciers. And then after the glaciers receded, they kind of slowly moved north. Chestnuts dispersed more slowly than some of the other tree species, but they got to New England and the northern part of their range at least a couple thousand years ago. But then there was this one population of chestnuts in southern Ontario that seemed to match chestnuts from the Carolinas more closely than it matched nearby chestnut populations. And so the best hypothesis was that that might have been along a native trade route that might have meant that indigenous groups were directly transporting chestnuts from the Carolinas to this area in southern Ontario and perhaps other areas in the northern part of the chestnut range. There are also some stories of fire ecology and fire management and ways that chestnuts might be well adapted to fire and how prescribed fire or fire intentional management using fire might suppress invasive plants and might be important in restoring or reintroducing American chestnuts. So we actually have a student who's starting to look at that and looking at what traits of chestnut might be similar to oaks and other known fire-tolerant species that have been studied since chestnuts declined. So that's an important both historical and future consideration also. The idea of restoring American chestnut trees, of restoring an entire species to an ecosystem that's changed since its loss, is really daunting and complicated because there's the range of the American chestnut was huge. And also there are several other threats besides chestnut blight. So even a wonderfully blight-tolerant chestnut tree wouldn't solve chestnut restoration, because there are so many different traits and different things that'll be important to consider throughout the range of the chestnut and ways to address these other pests. But what's exciting to me is that our research group has developed trees with notably enhanced tolerance to chestnut blight. There'll never be a single perfect tree, like I said, but the trees we've developed are a really important big step in this long history of attempts to address chestnut blight. And so certainly these trees won't solve the problem. They won't be the only solution, but they're an important step. And there are ways that the trees we've already produced can be improved. And we're working on several subsequent iterations that might improve blight resistance even further and start to address some of these other pathogens, some of the other threats to the trees. There's promise. There's trees with enhanced blight resistance, and we haven't been able to say that about American chestnuts since the problem started.
There's quite a community of people who are rallying together for the American chestnut. Describe that set. Describe those people.
Chestnutters are definitely a unique group, and like you said, it's this passionate following. And I think some of that comes from the unique aspects of the tree and comes from the history of cultural and economic importance. People describe their grandparents telling them about chestnut trees and how great these trees were and how delicious the chestnuts were. And so there's still kind of an active cultural history surrounding chestnuts. But also I think the idea of restoring a tree, the idea that we can address the human-caused problem and actually do something about an environmental problem, and that really offers hope, and that's something that people gravitate toward.
If you love stories related to saving trees, reforestation, rewilding, anything like that, well, here on Constant Wonder, we have delved into such topics before. Check out Season 2, Episode 28. There you can hear Australian Tony Renato discovering for himself the power of tree roots to revegetate and restore vast degraded tracts of land in West Africa and elsewhere around the world. Or you might want to come to byuradio.org. Just search this name, Isabella Tree. Yes, that's her last name, actually. Tree, Isabella Tree. And you'll hear an inspiring story of rewilding hundreds of acres in southern England. And if you enjoy what we bring to you here on Constant Wonder, please leave us a 5-star rating and a favorable review on your favorite podcast platform. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening.